Welcome to Great Australian Lives.
For Tobin Brothers Funerals,
celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is going to help shed some light on the long struggle that Indigenous people have fought to tell the truth about Australia's black history and to win representation in our political system. He's a writer and a professor of history at Monash University, and his new book tells the story of a remarkable Aboriginal man, William Cooper. It is my pleasure to welcome Bain Attwood to Great Australian Lives. How are you, Bain?
I'm very well. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you for being on the show. Now, before we get into the inspiring story of William Cooper, we want to acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians on the land in which this program is produced, and we pay our respects to all First Nations people and acknowledge elders past, present and emerging. Now, you are a professor of history at Monash University. I think I already mentioned that in the intro, but this has been a fascinating 18 months. Have you been doing everything remotely, or have you returned to normal at Monash?
We certainly haven't returned to normal. There's been moments when we've been able to teach our tutorials face-to-face, but for most of the last four semesters, it's all been online.
Like everyone. And as someone who's dedicated their career to history, in a nutshell, how would you put the history of the last 18 months?
Well, I suppose it's reminded a lot of people, and particularly historians, of the Spanish flu epidemic, shortly after the end of the First World War, and it's sent historians to think a great deal about the impact of epidemics on us human beings. But of course, that was a fair time ago, 100 years ago. But historians have become very interested in epidemic diseases and the impact they can have on communities.
Absolutely. Do you know? I don't know if you know much about the Spanish flu epidemic, but do you know whether these sort of moments in time change cultures or change populations in any significant way?
Look, I think there is a lot of evidence that it does. I guess we're already conscious of some of the profound changes that have occurred in the wake of this pandemic, and I guess while some of those will be turned back, it'll be rather surprising if they don't have a continuing impact on the way we live our lives.
Absolutely. Now, were you still in the process of writing your new book when COVID shut everything down?
Well, very much so. I did work on William Cooper over 20 years ago, but he always fascinated me, and so I was drawn back to it. And I actually wrote the entire book last year during the pandemic.
Oh, right.
I guess as a tribute to the fact that so many of the historical materials that historians need these days have been digitized, that once upon a time you would have had to look at, for example, the hard copies of newspapers. You'd have had to go to archives and research libraries. But I was lucky in the sense that I'd already collected a lot of material, but I did seek more material, and I was very fortunate that I could find it in a digital form, and some other historians helped me out in a few instances, and some librarians, for example, at the National Library of Australia were incredibly helpful. So I was able to plough on, as it were.
And we've actually spoken with a few authors on this show in the last little while, and they have said that lockdown actually worked really well for them. Is that the case for you, that you were able to just, with every great excuse, hide away?
Yes, look, sometimes people joke that academics self-isolate at the best of times. And I guess some of this is a matter of personality, that if you're introverted, the introverts have probably coped better with the pandemic and the lockdowns than extroverts. I have to admit, I'm not sure what this says about me, but I've done all right. I wrote a book last year. I'm in the middle of writing another book now. And so I count myself fortunate.
I've got to say, I'm a bit of an introvert too, so I didn't suffer as most as some others. Now, the new book is a biography of William Cooper. Can you explain who was William Cooper?
Now, William Cooper was a Yorta Yorta man. He was born on the banks of the Murray River in about 1860. By this time, the invasion of his people's land had been going on for something like 20 years. So they'd been dispossessed of most of their land, displaced to some degree. And he grew up on the banks of the Murray River. He was born to a Yorta Yorta woman, and his biological father was a white man, perhaps one of the fishermen on the river. His people had a lot of skills in relation to the river that a fishing company that was established at the time by some white men, they drew upon the resources of his community. In about 1874, he was drawn to a Christian mission that was established near Barmer, established by two missionaries, Daniel and Janet Matthews. And while he didn't stay on this mission, which came to bear the Aboriginal name Maloga, he returned there in the early 1880s. He married, he converted to Christianity, and remained a firm Christian for the rest of his life. Maloga was replaced by an Aboriginal reserve called Cummeragunga, and Cooper moved really on and off both Maloga and Cummeragunga for a good deal of his life. A lot of the time he's working as a pastoral worker, not only in the area, but further afield. He becomes involved in the rights of workers. We know he belonged to a couple of trade unions, that he subscribes to a trade union newspaper, The Australian Worker. But then in 1933, so by this time he's in his early to mid-70s, he decides that he wants to well and truly take up the cause of his people, and that in order to have the resources that he would need to fight that campaign, he decided to move to Melbourne. So he does this in 1933, and then he spends the remaining years of his life. He passes away in 1941. He spends the remaining years of his life fighting on behalf of his people here in Melbourne. So that's a kind of brief overview of his life. Once he comes to Melbourne in 1933, he forms an organisation called the Australian Aborigines League. It primarily comprises of Aboriginal people who are really exiles from their own country, from Cummeragunga specifically. So it's very much an enterprise where it's not only Cooper alone by any stretch of the imagination, but others, most notably Margaret Tucker, Doug Nicholls, Shadrach James are the names that most readily come to mind.
He was described by Senator Pat Dodson. He said he plumbed the pulses of political power to advocate for his people and the Commonwealth to manage Aboriginal affairs. What drove him? What was there? Was there something that put the fire in his belly to do this? What do you know? What his big influence was to change things?
Look, I think it very much grows out of his own experience, what we might call his historical experience of his people being dispossessed of their land, of being displaced, of being discriminated against, of being deprived of sometimes even the basic necessities. When I first worked on or wrote about William Cooper 20 years ago, I was aware that his work grew out of this. But in writing this biography, I learned much more about his early life. And you know, I guess, accustomed to the notion now of the enormous suffering that Aboriginal people suffered. But this was certainly true of Cooper as well. Even though he was, in a sense, armed with some really important resources in order to be able to take up the fight for Aboriginal people, he certainly had his own instances in his life where he suffers. Going back to a brief discussion we had about the pandemic, in the mid-1880s, shortly after, well, not all that long after he married, both his wife and one of his two children died in a typhoid epidemic. And to make matters worse, when his wife died, and she died in a hospital in Bendigo, as far as I can remember, the manager of Kamaragunja Reserve refused to allow him to bring her body, to lend him a cart, vehicle, to bring her body back to Kamaragunja and bury her. So, I mean, to say the least, that really rubbed salt into the wounds that he was already feeling. And then later in his life, some of his children die. For example, one of his sons, named after the missionary I mentioned before, Daniel Matthews, he's killed in the First World War. I think Cooper's very attached to this son. That causes him a lot of grief. And there are other instances where he loses members of his family. Now, in some ways, there was nothing unusual in that, because Aboriginal mortality rates were very high because of the deprivation they suffered. But so that's part of what compels his work. I think it's also the case that Christianity has a profound influence upon him, that Daniel Matthews, along with some other Christian figures in 19th century Australia, very strongly believed that Aboriginal people had been dispossessed of their land. They believed that white Australia, so to speak, had duties or obligations towards Aboriginal people because they were the first peoples of the land. And he very much, not surprisingly, took that on board. The missionaries were also very well connected to the anti-slavery movement in the early 19th century. And so this provides what I would call the political language that Cooper takes up. It's also the case that Daniel and Janet Matthews, in teaching Aboriginal people about Christianity, I think they encouraged the Aboriginal people to identify with the Jews of the Bible. In other words, the dispossession of Jewish people and the promise that the Jewish people would one day be returned to place, would one day return, if you like, to their homeland. And I think this is very important to Cooper, and you can see it in his work. I think it's also the case that the Matthews, one of the ways in which they work is by placing emphasis on music. Some of the songs that are sung there at Maloga and Kamaragunja are songs that are an African-American group, the Fisk Singers, who actually visited Maloga in the mid-1880s. They pass on some of their songbooks. And so there's this really strong identification with other, if you like, other racial minorities. And this all becomes part and parcel of, I think, what enables Cooper to take up the cause of his people.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Well, let's hear more about that after the break. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. Our guest tonight is Bain Attwood, Professor of History at Monash University. And more with Bain in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is writer and historian Bain Attwood, whose new biography, William Cooper and Aboriginal Life Story, sheds light on one of Australia's most influential Indigenous men and his struggle for justice for his people. Now, we were talking all about what propelled and inspired him before the break, Bain Attwood, but there is a really significant part of his story when he petitioned King George V for an Aboriginal representative in the Australian Parliament. That's a bold move.
Yes, very much so. I think what's interesting here is, well, if you like, the contemporary resonance of what he was seeking in this petition. But yes, this is a petition that he has drawn up soon after he arrives in Melbourne in 1933. And he comes to this, if you like, with a long history amongst his people of petitioning government, that we know that Cooper was associated with petitions of the Yorta Yorta people going back to the 1880s. So there's a sense in which he has a lot of experience in the political form of petitioning. It's also the case that well, not only Aboriginal people, but Indigenous people throughout the British Empire, had a tradition of petitioning the Queen, that they, or the King, the British monarch, that they believed, quite rightly in some sense, that the British monarch stood at the top of the Australian political system. They believed that the British Crown, either in the form of the Queen or the King, had undertaken or given promises to their people. So Maori in New Zealand, Native peoples in North America and Africa, they all started to petition Queen Victoria in the 19th century. And in Cooper's case, and in the petition itself, he actually says, and this was his understanding, that when the British started to colonise here, that they had given Aboriginal people an undertaking to protect their interests. So he invokes that historical understanding. It's not, by any stretch of the imagination, a treaty, but some of the premises or assumptions that Cooper brought to the petition are somewhat like that of a treaty, in my view.
And Baynap, how was it received? First of all, how did the general public, what was their sentiment towards him doing this? I can imagine there would have been a part of Australia that were affronted by William Cooper doing this. But also, secondly, how was it received by the King?
There's a number of aspects to that story. I mean, in the first place, perhaps we should just note how difficult it was for an Aboriginal man in 1933 to get a petition up, and then more so, to circulate it. Cooper himself had only had the opportunity to have a small amount of formal education. And so he was somebody who had learnt to read well, and I think he read voraciously. But when it came to writing, certainly by 1933, whatever skills he had in writing had grown rusty. And by his own admission, he struggled to write. And so he needed the assistance of others, Thomas and Shadrach James, who were part of his family, helped, as did a white man by the name of, a white man by the name of Arthur Bourdeau, lent a lot of help. Cooper had to, first of all, he believed he needed to seek the permission of the various state governments in order to be able to circulate the petition. That he knew that anybody who did this sort of thing could be accused of being a political troublemaker. Now, he had the advantage that he was no longer, by that time, living on Cummeragunga. He was no longer living on an Aboriginal reserve with all the kind of control that the managers of reserves or protection boards used to exercise. He was living in Melbourne. He was independent. He had an old age pension. He also had a pension as a result of one of his sons being killed in the First World War. This didn't give him much money by any means, but it meant that he had some degree of independence. So he had to write to all the protection boards or state governments asking for permission. Some of them were, in his view, dreadfully slow to reply. Sometimes, not surprisingly, he got quite frustrated and saying, you know, why are they doing this? Anyway, in the end, he got permission. And was able to gather something in the order of 1,800 signatures. I think it's also interesting to note that with this petition, only Aboriginal people were allowed to sign it. So it was very much an Aboriginal protest. He wasn't seeking the signatures of white Australians. It was only Aboriginal people. The petition, when it was launched in September 1933, it gets quite a lot of attention in the newspapers. Some of it is sympathetic, particularly from the Labor press, the trade union press. Others, I think, feel very uncomfortable, are very uneasy about what he's doing. And as so often when people are uneasy, they use humour to denigrate what Cooper was trying to do. But he was a very persistent man. He, you know, whatever the obstacles, almost he just kept on going. So he's able to circulate the petition. As I said, he got something like 1,800 signatures, mostly from missions and reserves across some parts of the country. And then by 1935, I think the petition is probably pretty much ready to go. It could be presented. But he decides that it's strategically sensible to hold the petition back for a while and see if he can persuade government, and particularly the federal government, to actually do what he wants, to address what we would call the disadvantage of Aboriginal people, to introduce measures that will address the poverty and so forth that they suffer. So he holds it back. And then in 1937, he has very high hopes of what was really the first ever conference of the white administrators of Aboriginal affairs. And nothing comes out of that as far as he's concerned. He says at one point, we ask for bread, we look like we're only going to get a stone. I mean, it's very much influenced by, you know, his biblical language, if you like.
Yeah.
And so eventually he decides he's going to present the petition. Now, the rules of the game, so to speak, was that you couldn't present a petition directly to the British Crown in London. You had to work through the federal government. So he submits it to the federal government. And he realises quite soon afterwards that they are going to try and, as it were, deal with it themselves. And the fact of the matter is that the petition, as far as we know, was never sent on to the British Crown. And in fact, while the Prime Minister of the day, Joseph Lyons, seems quite sympathetic, some of his colleagues, some of the senior public servants of the day, are very, very critical of what Cooper is asking for. In fact, some of them are quite dismissive of the notion that an Aboriginal person could represent their own interests in Parliament. But this is a cause that is very dear to Cooper's heart. He passionately believes that there is this problem that, and the way he put it was that Aboriginal people could think black. This was his term, think black or thinking black. And that they had a particular perspective to offer. And it was a perspective that grew out of their experience, that he believed that for the most part, white Australians could not think black. At one point he says, well, they are the victors and we are the sufferers. They are our conquerors and we are the sufferers. So why he wanted representation of Aboriginal people in the federal parliament was that he believed that white Australians did not know what meant to be Aboriginal, what their experience had been since colonisation began in 1788, and that this was a much-needed perspective. I mean, in other words, what Cooper was saying is what Aboriginal people have continued to say and what they've said most recently in the form of the Uluru Statement, that what we need, in Cooper's term, was not a voice to Parliament, but a voice in Parliament. He believed that one of the fundamental problems was that there was no Aboriginal perspective in the federal Parliament, there was no Aboriginal perspective in state parliaments, but all the way down. So, for example, the councils, that on Aboriginal reserves where a large number of Aboriginal people lived, that these were controlled by white management, and that what needed to happen was councils needed to be established on these reserves, and they needed to include Aboriginal representation or Aboriginal representatives.
And it's sad that that is still, in a way, an argument that is still dragging on, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I suppose what Cooper was saying and what Aboriginal people are still saying is, listen to what we're saying, and that we're not going to get anywhere until we have Aboriginal voices incorporated in the Australian polity in one form or another.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is Bain Attwood, who is a professor of history at Monash University, and we'll be back with him in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is Professor Bain Attwood, whose new biography of William Cooper has been described as an important tribute to the work and life of an extraordinary Aboriginal activist. Now, Bain, we've talked all about the life of William Cooper, but I want to know about you. You're a Kiwi.
I am indeed, but perhaps I should say that I've now lived in Australia longer than I ever lived in New Zealand.
So can we claim you?
No, I still support the All Blacks. I am a citizen, but I think, you know, as one ages, one returns to one's early years. I mean, I've been here. I came in 1981 when I was in my mid-20s, and I've lived here pretty much ever since. I've had time in Britain and the United States in universities there on fellowships, but I came with the idea that I was going to do my PhD, which I did at La Trobe University, that I was going to stay for 3 or 4 years, and then I was going to go off and see the rest of the world and return to New Zealand. But as I said, I've been here ever since.
Where in New Zealand did you grow up? North or South Island?
I grew up in the North Island, in the Waikato. I guess a pretty typical childhood of the time, that while I went to schools where there were some Māori children, it was the heyday, if you like, of assimilation, and Māori were, even though the idea was that they were going to be sort of included in the Australian mainstream, there's various ways in which they were marginalised. It was a time when certainly Māori was not taught in schools. So there's been a lot of change, an enormous amount of change since
they've done better than Australia, I would argue.
Yeah, a lot of changes. I mean, in some ways, you know, the position of Māori is very similar to Aboriginal people. I mean, if you look at the basic socioeconomic facts of the lives of many Māori, they have a lot in common, so to speak, with Aboriginal people. But one of the big differences that plays itself out in various ways is, of course, the fact that there was a historic treaty in New Zealand, the Treaty of Waitangi, which was made in 1840. And while the treaty was often breached, in fact, more often breached than honoured in recent years, beginning in the mid-1970s, but then more especially from the mid-1980s, the Treaty of Waitangi has become a very, very important reference point in New Zealand life. It's brought about some change, at least, for some Māori people. But there have been, yes, as I said, quite considerable changes in New Zealand in the last 40 years.
Yeah, I used to live and work in the North Island, and I was only there for a year, but I remember being heartened by the representation of Māori people in comparison to Aboriginals in Australia. I felt as though there was a better level of representation in politics and even across media and that sort of thing. They had a better platform, arguably, in my opinion. But I want to know about you, Bain. What builds the building blocks of a history? I don't know if it's trivial to call you a history buff, but a professor in history. Where did that come from?
Before I answer that question, perhaps I could just go back to something you raised before, and that is the degree of Māori representation. And just note that one of the things that informed Cooper's work, informed his petition, his call for an Aboriginal representative in the federal parliament in Australia, was that he knew that Māori people had been granted 4 parliamentary seats, 4 seats in the New Zealand parliament in 1867. Mm. And this is a matter that he repeatedly draws the attention of white Australian political figures to. He says, well, this is long overdue here in Australia for Aboriginal people, because Māori have had parliamentary representation since 1867. It's something that he, as I said, he very much knows, and he repeatedly draws the attention of his political masters too. Mm. In terms of my work as a historian, I guess it's true to say, and a lot of historians would say this, or perhaps many of us would say this in terms of the work we've ended up doing, is that having a passionate school teacher made all the difference. And I can remember in 1970 or 1971 when I was at school in New Zealand and reaching the stage of doing the first kind of qualifications that mattered in the New Zealand school system, and wondering what I would do. And really only by accident, I think, deciding that I was going to do history, recognizing that I had no linguistic capacities and that it would be a mistake to do French for a major leaving exam called school certificate. So I, in a way, fell into history, and I was taught by an English man. He didn't really care very much about New Zealand history, but he was passionate about British history, European history, the history, for example, of the Second World War. And there was something, I think, about his passion that drew me to the subject of history. And I went on from there. I left school. I went to a local university, the University of Waikato. And what was unusual, I guess, or at least different at that time, is that it was just taken for granted that history departments in New Zealand universities in the mid-1970s would offer at least one subject in the history of relations between Māori and Pākehā, and that was between Māori and non-Māori people in New Zealand. In Australia at that time, it was very, very unusual, although having said that, I want to note that when I came here in 1981 to do my PhD at La Trobe, my PhD supervisor was a wonderful historian by the name of John Hurst. And he, in fact, in the mid-1970s, had begun teaching a course which he described as a course in Aboriginal history. But he was probably the only historian in Australia teaching a course like that. In terms of what a historian needs, I guess a very important part of it is, is the research and an interest in spending a long periods of time in archives and libraries trying to find historical sources. I mean, historical information. In my case, for a long time, I've been very interested in how we can do what historians called Aboriginal history. And Aboriginal history is a very particular approach to the past. It's an approach that was taken up by a group of historians, anthropologists, archaeologists, linguists at the Australian National University in the mid-1970s. And they believed, they were very dissatisfied with the kind of historical work that was being done at that time. It's actually a kind of work that historians continue to do. They were dissatisfied because it was work that very much focused on Aboriginal dispossession, displacement, decimation, deprivation. And their view was, yes, well, of course, that was a crucial part of the story that needed to be told. But they believed that this was a story that was being very much taught from the white fella's perspective, and that what was needed was a history which focused on Aboriginal people themselves as subjects, that focused on what historians call somebody's agency, in other words, their capacity to at least shape to some degree their lives, and most importantly, on Aboriginal perspectives. And this is how I've approached this book, to try and understand Cooper's life from, as much as a white fella can do this, from an Aboriginal angle, from an Aboriginal perspective. But one of the problems that one comes up against is the question of, well, what historical sources, what sources of information are available to the historian? Now, as you and your listeners would know, Aboriginal people, certainly in the 19th and into the 20th century, but still to some degree today, have what we might describe as an oral culture. And as I said before, in Cooper's case, he didn't have much opportunity for formal education in English in his childhood or any other point. And so his capacity to write was limited. And that's true of, you know, of all his peers, as well as later generations. And so when the historian goes to the archive and is looking at written material, quite often there are very few what we would call Aboriginal voices. I mean, Cooper is unusual because he becomes politically active in the ways I've described, and so he, in a sense, creates a historical record. But having done that, and this is one of the problems for any biographer of somebody, of an Aboriginal man like William Cooper, is that all of what he writes or is written in his name, it's all has a very much a public face. So there's hardly anything in the historical record where Cooper is talking about his personal life.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we can draw on other sources, and I've done that for the book. I've worked closely with members of Cooper's family. And one of his grandsons, Uncle Boydie Turner, who's in his early 90s, and who I've worked with in this project, he lived for a short period of time with William Cooper in Melbourne. Cooper was based in Footscray. He lived in a series of houses in Footscray, and Uncle Boydie joined him there for a while. But he was, you know, he was just a boy. He was a young boy at this time. And so while he's got some memories of his grandfather, not surprisingly for a child of his age, the age he was at that time, they're not as broad and as deep as we, you know, as ideally they would be. And certainly there's an oral tradition amongst Cooper's family. At some points that agrees with his written historical record. At other points it diverges. Also, Cooper was you know, very poor throughout his life. He moved a lot. And so the very conditions that enable anybody or anybody at that time to preserve a record of their work in writing is very, very limited. I mean, so Cooper has no personal papers that he left. But what he did have, and I think it's interesting and important to know, is that he treasured photographs of himself and his family. And these were photographs that were circulated within the family. And one of the enormous pleasures I've had in writing the book is to discover photographs that I certainly, that are not part of the public realm, you know, they're not part of a public library or an archive, that they are still held by members of the Cooper family. I wasn't aware of these photographs. The family have been very generous in helping me with the book, and part of the help has come in the form of lending me some really wonderful photographs of Cooper, which I don't think anybody outside of the family and a few others have ever seen. For example, there's, a wonderful photo of Cooper striding down Nicholson Street, the main shopping street in Footscray, sometime after 1933. He's clearly walking, striding purposefully. I mean, he's in his mid-70s by this stage, but he's physically strong. He has he has enormous dignity, wonderful bearing. And so there's photos like that. The other photos include him. There's one shot of him talking to other members of the league, and you just get the sense of how much they respected and admired him. So these photographs, in other words, the visual material, and sometimes going back to some of what I said before, a choir was formed at Maloga, it carried on in Cummeragunga, and part of Cooper and the Australian Aborigines League's protest was that they would stage concerts. And so singing was very important. So I guess what I'm talking about here is both a visual and an oral element, which is very important and allows us, if we think carefully about what they sing and these photographs, it adds a really, I think, really important dimension.
Yeah, I just finished the book Archie Roach wrote about his own life. I don't know if you've come across him, but he talks a lot about the importance of finding those photos of his family through the years and how important they are to visualise that history as well. It is a fascinating life that you have led, Bain Attwood. Let's come back to it with a little wrap-up just after the break. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tonight, our guest is Professor Bain Attwood, whose new biography of William Cooper has been described as an important tribute to the work and life of an extraordinary Aboriginal activist. Now, Bain, you have spent time at Harvard and Cambridge, but particularly Harvard. I want to understand what reputation does Australian history have from the point of view of other academics there?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Perhaps I should explain that there's a visiting professorship of Australian Studies, and this was founded during the Whitlam years in government. This was Gough Whitlam's idea. I think, first of all, he thought that he would try and persuade Yale University to accept the bequest from the Australian government, but in the end, it went to Harvard. In more recent years, the chair has been renamed after both him and Malcolm Fraser, which is an interesting turn, but apparently both men were in agreement that the chair could be renamed the Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser Chair of Professorship of Australian Studies. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, I think it's a wonderful opportunity for someone to hold this chair. You hold it for an academic year. Harvard, as you would realise, has most extraordinary resources, wonderful library, for example. Mm. But in the biggest scheme of American academic life, Australian studies, let alone Australian history, doesn't figure all that strongly. Although, to be fair to the Department of History at Harvard, there are a very small number of historians of something like an 80 or 90 strong staff who are interested in Australia, who have quite strong contacts with Australia and its historians. They make you feel very welcome, but you certainly, a very, very small fish in a big pond. Whatever you try to do while you're there.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be such a fascinating place to be, but very, very daunting at the same time. Now, with you, Bain Atwood, are you going to be able, now that we're sort of opening up, are you going to be able to promote the book in person?
Look, I don't think so, but there are plenty of opportunities to have interviews like this one today. We're going to have a launch event, but that's going to be done online through Reading's Bookshop in 10 days.
Yes,
or so.
I was reading about that.
But as you know, we're all making do, aren't we?
We are.
We have been during the pandemic, and I guess we've learned lots of skills and become frustrated in ways we didn't know we could become frustrated before.
Well, I want to thank you for spending so much time with us, Bain Atwood. It has been a pleasure and an honour to learn so much about you and about William Cooper as well.
Thanks very much for the opportunity, Laura.
And thank you so much for our chat tonight. And of course, if you're listening and you're interested, Professor Bain Atwood's book, William Cooper, An Aboriginal Life Story, has just been released and it is, of course, available at all good bookstores. And if you've enjoyed our chat with Bain Atwood tonight, please subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast and join me the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.